Accession number 24925, Reel 5.
This is the third reel of a tape to do with Don Anderson in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 11th of the 3rd, 2003, at the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. You've been talking about your trip to Gibraltar, and I wanted to remind you to tell us the story about the cigarette.
Oh, yes. On takeoff from Port Reith, I've been waiting there a while, and I'm a bit nervous about the length of the trip to, and the amount of fuel, and we finally took off over this cliff at Port Reith. The runway finished at the end of the start of a cliff, and went into bad weather. When I say bad weather, it was pretty heavy cloud, and finally broke through, climbing up to, on our way to Spain, got to about 6,000-7,000 feet, and I was so relieved to see this, so I decided to light a cigarette. And I remember the blue packets of Player cigarettes, paper packets, and I lit one, and I just got it alight when it somehow or other slipped out of my fingers, down through the floorboards of this bow fighter into the bottom of the aircraft, and I thought, well, there's nothing I can do about it, and I didn't tell my navigator because there's nothing he could have done about it. So I had a most uncomfortable 10 minutes waiting to, for the aircraft to blow up, and the outcome of that is that I've never smoked in an aircraft since. And also on the way down, going direct from Portugal to Gibraltar, to conserve fuel, I flew over Cadiz, and we were fired on at Cadiz, AC-AC, black bursts of AC-AC, but quite a long way away.
What was the feeling like to know that you were actually being fired at?
Well, the AC-AC was a long way away. It wasn't as bad as the feeling that I got later on in action. But it was a strange feeling. Anyhow, we left Bleeder and headed, at that stage, Soos and Sfax were being attacked by the, or being defended by the Germans. And we were supposed to go from Bleeder to Marble Arch to refuel, which is in the North African coast. But we're routed to fly due south from Bleeder over the Atlas Mountains about 100 miles, turn east, fly for a certain distance, then head north for Castel Bonito. We're going to land at Castel Bonito, that's right. And the interesting thing about Castel Bonito had been just recently captured by the Allies, and there were a lot of Italians. The Italians were walking around the city unarmed, but it was rather strange to see the enemy at hand, and I was amazed that they looked quite docile, and there was nothing untoward about them.
Well, these are the people that you were supposedly at war against.
Yes, well, of course, they'd been captured. The Italians had been captured there. We drank quite a bit of their beautiful red wine at Castel Bonito, but we had to drink it out of a chipped enamel mug, and wine doesn't taste its best out of a chipped enamel mug, but the wine was considered to be very good.
What sort of contact did you have with the Italians?
Well, I just waved, and I didn't speak to any. And they seemed to be going about their business in this beautiful town of Castel Bonito.
Earlier on you'd mentioned, if you'd been German, what would you have done in relation to joining the war? here you were seeing chaps like yourself from a different country. How did that make you feel about the situation of war?
Well, it didn't change anything, really. I just thought, well, you know, they were doing their thing and I was doing mine. Pardon me. But anyhow, I left Castel Bonito after about a day and flew along the road to Marble Arch, and we flew at about 50 feet. I enjoyed flying low. We passed all these trucks heading up towards the battle at Sousse and Fax, and they got they must have been a bit apprehensive going up towards the front line, and to see a plane whip over their heads couldn't have improved their morale. I didn't realise that at the time. Anyhow, we landed at this place, Marble Arch, which was most interesting, an enormous marble arch in the middle of the desert, or it's on the coast, and it was erected there by Mussolini and to commemorate where two runners from different countries, there was a dispute as to where the border would be, and they said, we'll get a runner from each country, and where they meet, that'll be the border. And so anyhow, they met at this place, and they built a marble arch. Anyhow, there was an RAF airfield there, and while we were there, it was discovered the aircraft had a very bad oil leak, which meant that the oil tank had to be changed. And so we were there in this desert situation with nothing to do, Dick and myself, and we'd occasionally be driven over to the beach for a swim. And it was very pleasant, a little bit of surf. And one of the most hazardous, dangerous things that I've ever done in the war was at Marble Arch. Dick and I decided to walk direct to the beach, which we did from the airfield, about a mile, I think. And we walked there, and coming back, we saw a lot of trenches and leaking fuel and signs of battle. And we walked straight back to our camp. Then we were told we had gone through a minefield, unbeknown to us. And it makes me shudder to think we just plodded around there. We were just very lucky. Anyhow, while I was there, there was an interesting man called Win Eaton, a wing commander, Win Eaton, who was flying. He landed at Marble Arch, and he was flying a German aircraft back to Cairo. What he used to do, I think he was the nephew of the fellow, someone in charge of the Air Force, or Army, or Navy. And he's an old guy, about 40 years. Anyhow, ancient, and he'd been flying in the First World War, and he wanted something to do, and his nephew had said, well, you can ferry these aircraft around. So he used to take aircraft up to where they were needed, full of beer for the troops, and then he'd get back any way he could. Well, he managed to get this captured aircraft, a twin-engined aircraft, Messerschmitt, I think. And anyhow, he was going to, where was it? Benina, over the water. So I said I'd like to go and do a trip with him over there. So he got into this aircraft, and there's no one I had to ask, or just did it. And he got into this aircraft, and you can see that his, all the instruments are labeled in German. And he got in, and he inadvertently pulled up the undercarriage lever. Nothing happened, so he put it down again very quickly, and we took off. It was leaking glycol everywhere. It was a dreadful mess. Anyhow, we landed at Benghazi, somewhere around there. And, of course, I had to hitchhike back to get back to the plane, which I did. And but it was quite an adventure. And then we took off from Cairo West, from Marble Arch for Cairo West. We flew over Tobruk, saw the escarpment there. It was quite interesting. And down on the, and I remember flying into towards Cairo. We landed at a place called LG224, LG being landing ground. And instead of giving them names, they gave them numbers. And I remember flying over the top of the pyramids and looking at them and wondering at them. Anyhow, we landed at...
What was your impression of seeing the pyramids?
It was breathtaking. I enjoyed it. And
you've been talking about your experience in North Africa, obviously, in a place where... Alamein had taken place in a place where a lot of the earlier battles, particularly in regard early successes for the Allies, had taken place. Talking of Tobruk, what were the stories that you've heard of Tobruk?
Oh, friends of mine, Peter Salmon was at Tobruk. A lot of friends of mine were at Tobruk, and we heard that they... They had a pretty tough time. They were surrounded. No one could get to them. And they had to fight off the Germans. And the Germans called them the Rats of Tobruk. That's where the name came from, I think, the Rats of Tobruk. But they were eventually relieved and they, as the war went further west. And, of course, flying over there, you could see broken down tanks and burnt out vehicles and signs of the conflict. Anyhow, we...
What did it feel like to know that you were flying over battlefields that had been decisive in relation to the situation now that the Germans are finding themselves in North Africa?
Well, not much. I just thought it was behind the the enemy line, and where it was no different really to any other flying.
To what degree did you feel as though you were in a vacuum in relation to a war going on around you? You hadn't actually taken part in anything yet.
Well, no. The idea of getting this plane, of flying, of ferrying this plane from England to the Middle East, and where we knew we were going to this Cairo Al-Mazar, and we'd be in a camp there, and we'd be awaiting posting, and people would be posted to various places around Africa, and we didn't know where we're going. All we knew we were going to Cairo. And I had a great job. I relieved Robin Cameron, who was in charge of the tents, the setting out of tents, and had to keep them in a straight line. And, of course, people had been there for a few weeks and they'd done marvellous things to their tents. They'd dug the floor down, probably 6 or 8 feet, lined it, and it was most comfortable. They made themselves very, very comfortable. And I had to get them in line, so I used to come along and say, now you have to move your tent 2 feet over this way, which wasn't too popular. Of course, mind you, they never did it. But it was always a laugh. And And I remember once at Cairo West, at Al-Mazar, I was posted. They said, Anderson, you're posted, and you're going to Malta. And be down there with your gear and at the office. And I was down there, and I was the first in line there, and with my kit bag and all the stuff. And I came up to the man. He said, now, what does your kit bag weigh? I said, I haven't weighed it. He said, go and weigh it. So there were 10 people, 10 crews required, and I finished up 7th on the list after that. So we're all braced and ready to go to Malta, which is pretty dicey do in those days. And word came through they only wanted 5 crews, so I didn't go. And those 5 crews that went all died. They're all gone. So if I hadn't, I'd have been gone too if I hadn't weighed my kit bag or weighed. But anyhow,
I'm interested because you mentioned earlier on that there was a lot of luck involved.
Oh yes, I think it is. I think there is. Yes, of course, there's a lot of luck, and there's.
Did you ever think of that? Did you ever think that deeply at the time?
Yes, I always thought I was lucky, because I think everyone thinks they're lucky. But it didn't worry me. It honestly didn't worry me.
What sort of philosophy that you adopt in relation to things like that?
Well, I never thought of it as a philosophy. It just didn't worry me. And it's an interesting point. I've never really given it any thought.
People talk about, oh, I'm lucky it didn't happen to me.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Better that it happened to someone else than it happened to me.
Well, yes, you think it never happened. But when you think of those bomber pilots, you could be the best pilot in the world, absolute ace pilot, and you'd go up there, it's like Russian roulette. The shells were coming up. They might miss you and miss the wrong go and hit the ace. No, it's luck. And I think it applies everywhere, really. Anyhow, thank goodness I managed to get through.
In relation to Malta, what were the stories that you'd been hearing up until that time about Malta and the importance?
Oh, well, it was, I think, round about that stage that they gave Malta the VC for so much bombing. It was being, there's some horrific stories about Malta. But in a way, when I was told I was posted there, I was looking forward to it. I don't think I was concerned about it, but I was very lucky I didn't go. But that's how it comes. And then when I left, I had some funny times in Cairo.
Tell us about a couple of funny times that you can recall.
Oh, well, I can remember. You know, there are various places off limits and off, you know, they say, don't go there, you'll be, the Arabs will turn you into mincemeat or whatever it was. But anyhow, it didn't seem to worry us much. We went everywhere and had a good look. And I can remember going along to some cafe, and I was offered a hubbly bubbly pipe. And I wasn't too keen on that, but anyhow, Dick had he was a great smoker. A navigator, and he puffed away at this hubbly bubbly pipe and said it was all right, and I had a few sucks on this tube, hubbly bubbly thing, and it was nothing of note, it was nothing anyhow as that, and it's a long while ago, but we enjoyed Cairo. Stella beer. We drank a lot of Stella beer, which is good beer.
Being in this exotic place, this place of mystery and all everything to do with
ancient
history. Yeah. Things like that. What was the atmosphere?
Well, it's really, if you wanted your shoes cleaned and you didn't give the shoe cleaning boy enough money, as he asked for, he'd smear your shoes and socks or whatever with black polish and he'd disappear in the crowd. I don't know whether they were really particularly well thought of, the Arabs. A lot of funny songs about the Arabs.
Do you recall any?
I can't remember the songs, but I can remember hearing a story about by Cyril Richardson. He was a rear gunner on Blenheims. And in the Blenheim, he was a radio operator, and in the Blenheim you had to reel out a trailing aerial. It was known as a trailing aerial, and you could pick up signals and you could send them up to these aerial picture. Anyhow, these fellas in the Blenheims weren't reeling in the aerials, and they were losing a lot of them as they came into land. And the CO said, if any more of this happens, you'll be fined £5, which was a lot of money in those days. Anyhow, Cyril Richardson said he came in one day and he forgot to bring his undercarriage up, but he was clever. He always had a spare set which he fitted himself. He was busy fitting this set of the training aerial when someone said, the CO wants to see you at once. And so Cyril went in with great apprehension. And he came out a bit white and shaken, and they said, what happened? And Cyril said, well, I knew I was in for it. As soon as I walked in the door, I saw that big Arab holding a camel's head under his arm. The trailing aerial must have done the job. But I it always appealed to me, that story. Anyhow,
how did they see you, do you think?
Oh, well, it was rather dreadful. They used to see, I remember hearing drivers say that if you ever run over an Arab, don't mess around. You've got to back up and finish him off. Don't try and save him, you'll be massacred. Whether that happened or not, I don't know, but that was the sort of feeling there. There's definitely an anti-feeling, I think, in the population.
In relation to the situation politically, they seem to have gone from being with the English when the English were going well, and for the Germans when the Germans were on their way to Alamein, and then back to the English again.
Yes, I should say so, yeah. I think that happens a lot in businesses. What a shame.
In relation to the situation, living in their land, what was it like to go out and manage to see some of the sights?
Oh, it was very good. I remember going to see the pyramids. Dick and I went to see the pyramids. And, very good. You paid someone so much and they were shown over into the pyramids. You were tourists, really. But one of the things that amazed me coming into Cairo is to see the Nile and the delta. And there would be white desert sand, then immediately vegetation, green vegetation. There was a complete demarcation, and which amazed me. I didn't think it would be like that. But anyhow,
had you been warned? I mean, you mentioned you've been warned, don't go down these streets, you'll be attacked by the Arabs.
Yeah.
What of the sort of fraternization with Arabs?
No, we didn't fraternize with, at least I didn't. We didn't fraternize at all. We were in this camp at El Marza, and We used to eat and sleep there. We'd catch the tram into Cairo. I remember I was called in once to headquarters, and I thought, this is interesting. I'm probably some promotion coming through. I was smarting myself up, and I went in there. And when I left Marble Arch, I'd been there for a while. Marble Arch camp was all tents, and I'd beaten them up a bit by flying very low, and I think I must have blown a lot of sand into the CO's tent, because this is a reprimand, and say, why did you do this? Because it blew the tent over, and I didn't know what to say, really. I just, I think I must have said fancy that. Anyhow, the fellow in interviewing me said, anyhow, never mind. So off I went again. I don't suppose he worried with the tent was blown over. And on. He knew I was on my way somewhere or other.
You were mentioning earlier on the situation with spending money. You had to spend some money in a particular experience. Otherwise, it would all go back to the...
Oh, yes. Yes, we're told it would go back to the NAFI. I don't know why the NAFI, but that's what we're told. So there's £1,500. So we had a big party. We invited all the nurses and all the girls we could lay our hands on, and we had put up a big marquee and had lots to eat and drink. And had a big party, spent a lot. So we were all very happy. And I was probably posted 2 or 3 days after that. And I was posted to India.
I'm interested in sort of living the life of, well, you might as well live it now. Tomorrow you may not be around.
Well, I don't know whether we ever thought like that. I don't think. No. I felt a bit like that later on when I was on ops, but it was all fun up to date.
That's the impression I get. It doesn't sound like much of a war.
Oh, no, no. Marvellous. I thoroughly enjoyed it up to that stage.
You've been mentioning that some of the experiences that you've had in relation to finding yourself in Cairo. In relation to the general situation of uncertainty, like snafu and all the rest. Was that something that you experienced? No one really knows what's going on.
No.
Everything's a bit sort of fouled up somehow.
Oh, yes. All fouled up, situation normal. I think that you realise this is how things will run. You know, I realised at that stage in my life that nothing's perfect. I think I mentioned before that any operation you ever did, there's always a mess up, but some were worse than others. So, but you coped with that.
You've been mentioning, obviously, the situation, the uncertainty, the not being quite sure where you're going to go until it's actually
happened. Yeah. Well, actually, what happened, the people I was on course with in England, my friend Rob Cameron, who joined up the same day in Perth, they had been sent to India by boat somehow or other. And I don't know why I was any different to the rest, but I think, as I say, I was sent to pick up a bow fighter earlier than they did. And I think all that was due to my name began with A. Just the luck of the draw.